Welcome to Believe is Question Worthy. Today we want to tackle a very challenging topic. It's about Bible passages that are not usually preached in churches, but which disturb many people, I think. And we have invited an expert, maybe the expert, to talk about this today. Hello, Professor Dr. Paul Copin. Thank you for your time.
It's good to be with you all. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, we have to talk a lot about these topics I mentioned. But first, let's get to know you, Paul, a little. And I hand over to Hannah. Hannah, who's Paul Copin?
Yes, it is my great honor to introduce you to this exceptional guest today. Dr. Copin is not only a distinguished philosopher and theologian, but also one of the leading Christian apologists of our time. With a PhD in philosophy from Marquette University as the Pledger Family Chair of Philosophy and Ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University, he has dedicated decades to defending and explaining the Christian faith. And Paul, you are the author of numerous influential books, including the widely acclaimed Is God a Moral Monster?, where you address ethical challenges in the Old Testament and True for You, but Not for Me, a brilliant work on objective truth in a realistic world. Your writings combine profound theological insights with clear and accessible reasoning. And yes, you are an internationally sought after speaker, and you have inspired countless individuals, building bridges between faith and reason. And your passion for truth and commitment to meaningful dialogue make you one of the most influential voices in contemporary Christian apologetics.
Yeah, it's so good to have you here today. Paul, do you have sometimes Bible passages where you think, oh man, that is disturbing?
Yeah, I think anyone who reads the scriptures will find certain texts troubling, challenging, just even reading the words of Jesus. Yeah, I was reading today and how Jesus' own followers found Jesus' teaching hard and difficult. And some people who were listening to Jesus left and no longer followed him. And so Jesus is one who does challenge us as well. So there are not only challenges in the Old Testament, but we also find Jesus very challenging. Someone who really penetrates our hearts, someone who speaks to our conscience, someone who basically never lets us rest. We can't just remain content with where we are spiritually. Jesus is always urging us forward. And so yes, there are difficult texts in both Old and New Testament, and perhaps for different reasons. But Jesus is also one who is informed by those challenging Old Testament texts, those difficult texts that speak about God who brings judgment. And we also see Jesus, who is also severe too. So hopefully as we go together, we'll look at these texts. And I'd also add that as we look at these texts, it's helpful to know that sometimes with some doing a little bit of homework and understanding the background and making certain connections theologically and morally, we start to see, I think, a clearer picture emerge. And so some of the harsh, stern language, it needs to be understood against the backdrop of an ancient culture. So I'm sure we'll unpack some of those things, but that's also very helpful to understand that sometimes the more deeply you dig, you realize, oh, maybe what I understood at first glance looked this way. Actually, there's a greater context that helps us to understand this, to put it in proper perspective, that sometimes there's hyperbole or exaggeration that is at work here. And so we need to understand that in our setting, just like when in our American context, when people say we totally annihilated that other team or we totally destroyed our opponents, no one takes that literally. And so it's important for us to understand that that is often how things operate in the ancient world as well.
Before we dive into difficult Bible passages, here's a fundamental question. Christians who engage with the God of the Old Testament, or maybe even with some difficult passages you mentioned, are often accused of simply glossing over his problematic actions instead of honestly asking whether God's action might be actually morally questionable. They seem to construct an argument to defend him. What's your take on this?
Well, yeah, I think we want to approach the text honestly and not simply gloss over difficulties or simply deny that there can be any kind of harshness or severity in God. And I think that we need to understand and maybe even let some of those difficult passages kind of sit in our hearts, sit in our minds as we ponder them, and let them have an effect that could perhaps reflect more clearly God's attitude towards sin, God's attitude toward those who defy him, God's attitude toward those who actually bring harm to others, who lead others into sin. And so there, Jesus himself in Matthew 18:6 said that those who lead his little ones, his followers astray, it'd be better for them to have a millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. So again, very severe language here, but there's a lot at stake as well. And sometimes we read the ancient text with kind of modern lenses, and we don't allow the ancient text to speak to us. And also we approach these texts, perhaps as Westerners, without a fuller understanding of what is going on in ancient culture and even in non-Western cultures today, where, for example, I was speaking in Canada a couple of months ago, and I spoke about the harsh sounding Psalms, what are called the imprecatory Psalms, and where where the psalmist says, "Lord, smash their teeth," and calling for God to bring an end to people who are engaging in oppression and injustice. And the person, I met a person who was involved in, friends of his were killed in the Rwandan genocide in the 1990s. And he said, "I find those psalms very comforting, that they're psalms of protection for me. They're psalms that I value because it shows that there's a God who is concerned about oppression and wickedness, and that you in your Western setting can't really appreciate what Christians often go through in other parts of the world." And so these psalms and war passages that seem so harsh to Westerners actually bring us great comfort in those sorts of settings in Africa or Asia where Christianity is under attack, where Christians are being persecuted, where women are being raped, and so forth. So those are the types of things that we need to also bring into the picture as well. So yes, there is severity, but when you look at maybe what's going on in the ancient culture, you realize maybe there's some things that I just am missing here that need to be taken into consideration as well. But you're right. We don't want to be superficial in glossing over them. And what I tell people to do is not to read in a superficial way, but actually dig more deeply into the text, because you realize that there's actually a lot more beneath the surface than what we might call a Sunday school approach to looking at, say, the book of Joshua. So there's a lot more nuance, a lot more texture, and just means doing some more homework to get to the bottom of some of these passages.
Okay, Paul. And we are going to challenge you with some of these passages, and we're curious to hear what you have to say. Okay, I want to start with a particularly difficult passage. Someone recently said to us, "How can you possibly see a God as good who commands genocide? For example, God orders Israel to wipe out the Amalekites, and I quote, 'Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys, or take the Canaanites, where God says, leave nothing that breathes alive.'" How would you respond to that?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. And let me say, first of all, that maybe I'll just take these two separately. Let me just first perhaps start with the Canaanites, where God says, leave alive nothing that breathes. And as we actually look at what God actually does say in the book of Joshua, where the Israelites are going into the land of Canaan, what do we see? We actually see the Israelites going into a land, first of all, a land that has people, inhabitants, who are engaged in all sorts of practices like incest, bestiality, infant sacrifice, ritual prostitution, things that would be considered criminal in any modern society. And so it's not as though these are people just really nice, decent people minding their own business. There's a lot of wickedness that is there. And so you see, and also God is waiting for over half a millennium. God speaks to Abraham in Genesis 15, 16, that he's going to wait until the sin of the Amorites, the Canaanite people, is filled up till it reaches maximum capacity, as it were. And it's only then that God commands the Israelites to drive out the Canaanites. For the Israelites to go in ahead of time, beforehand, would have been wrong. God is waiting for the right time. And this is waiting. This includes the Israelites going into Egypt and being enslaved there. So this is a very patient God who is waiting until that time is ripe. But even as God instructs the Israelites, he is telling them the primary command. And in fact, when you look at the driving out commands or the dispossessing commands in ratio to the, quote, destroy commands, the drive out commands are basically three times as many as those, quote, destroy passages. And the point is, if you're driving out the Canaanites, then they are still going to be alive. You're not killing them. Furthermore, what were the cities of the Canaanites like? Well, again, I'm not the only one speaking about this. There are plenty of biblical scholars who confirm this, but the cities of in the book of Joshua are, you know, even though the language of man, woman, young and old and so forth is used, these cities are fundamentally citadel cities where you have military and administrative officials in these cities that are basically the first point of defense when an invading nation might come in. The rest of the people are in hamlets and villages in the hill country and so forth. But these cities are actually, first of all, they're well fortified. They are cities that are, you know, have, as I said, they're not civilian populations. So when the Israelites are going in to drive out the Canaanites, they're not driving out man, woman, young and old and so forth. Even though that language is used, they are actually not present there in those cities. What we're talking about basically with the Canaanites and with the Amalekites too is it is pretty much combatant warfare. It's not combatants fighting against civilians, it's combatants fighting against combatants. And we'll unpack some of these things as we go along. But also keep in mind too that the Israelites, you know, they're not attacking a Canaanite people who are weak and hapless and vulnerable. These Canaanites are fierce. They have well-fortified cities. God tells the Israelites that they are more numerous than you. They have military equipment. The Israelites are not fighters. The Canaanites have the military equipment. They have the horses, the chariots, and so forth. And so, but God is telling the Israelites to go into the land to drive out the people, which is actually a very fearful undertaking. It requires trust in God because it's not going to be the result of military might that the Israelites drive out the Canaanites. It's going to have to be the Lord. And that's why the Lord says in Joshua 1:9, he says, you know, he tells him, don't fear, for I'm with you. You know, I'm with you wherever you go. That this is daunting. This is a challenge. And so you need to trust in me that it's not going to be by your sword that you prevail. And Joshua affirms this later on in the book, that it's not by the sword that the Canaanites are driven out, but by the power of God. So there is that dimension as well, that it requires trust in God rather than trust in military might to drive out the Canaanites. And these driving out the Canaanites largely was, these were disabling raids that the Israelites engaged in. They would go into these cities, drive out the inhabitants, again, soldiers and administrators, and then they would go back to their base camp at Gilgal. You also see that the Israelites have, you know, that the Canaanites already know who the God of Israel is, for 40 years, they have known that the Israelites were brought through the Red Sea after the Lord had already done, performed signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, and then eventually brought out the people of Israel to freedom. And so the Canaanites knew about this God of the Israelites. And so talk about having warning, having, you know, being prepared mentally for these people who are coming. There was the possibility of fleeing these places. But you also have the possibility, if you leave your idols behind, that you can join up with the Israelites, that But we read in Joshua 11:19 that there were no cities that wanted to make peace with the Israelites. There were some that made peace. Rahab made peace with the Israelites in Joshua chapter 2. In chapter 8, there are Canaanites who are with the Israelites in a covenant renewal ceremony. We see the Gibeonites who, though through devious means, align themselves with the Israelites. And do the Israelites protect them? But what we see is that largely the battles that the Israelites are fighting are defensive, that they're actually being attacked in the book of Joshua by a coalition of kings, that they are not the ones typically taking the initiative in battle, but are actually responding to those who are taking the initiative to fight against them. So these are the types of things that we need to take into consideration, and that the language that is used in Deuteronomy, for example, when it says, leave alive nothing that breathes, this language is very much exaggerated language, because you have alongside that language, for example, the Deuteronomy 7, when it says, leave alive nothing that breathes, it tells the Israelites to drive out the Canaanites and so forth. But then it goes on to say, and after you have, quote, destroyed them, it says, don't make any alliances with them. Don't intermarry with them. Well, if you've already destroyed them, what's the point of the prohibition to not to make alliances with them, or to the prohibition against intermarrying with them? That would make no sense. See, there is that kind of hyperbolized or exaggerated language that is being used throughout the book of Deuteronomy. And so let me just give a few examples here. And again, you can come back and ask some further questions. I'll get to the Amalekites, in a moment. But there's just a lot to say here about these battles. But when it comes to the Canaanites, we are often reading in the book of Joshua that even though people are, quote, utterly destroyed, or there's no survivor, we read sometimes the same chapter or a chapter or two later in the book of Joshua that those same people are there. That this is a common way of speaking in war texts. There's this language of hyperbole and exaggeration, where the pharaoh or the ruler will be described as leaving alive nothing that breathed, that there were no survivors, that he turned everyone to ash. Well, we know from history that this is actually an exaggeration, that you can have a very narrow victory, but these will be described as totally annihilating the enemy. And in the same way, we see this in the Old Testament, where you have warfare and you see a lot of survivors. In fact, we're told a couple of times in chapter 11 that Joshua did all that Moses commanded. Well, did Moses literally mean utterly destroyed, leave alive nothing that breathes? No, this is an exaggerated language, and Joshua is being described as doing what Moses commanded, even though we read throughout Joshua, as well as Judges chapter 1, that there were plenty of survivors, that the Israelites could not drive out the Canaanites and so forth. And we see side by side passages where these peoples in various cities have been destroyed, but then we read later on that they actually still are around. But unlike the ancient other, extra-biblical accounts of warfare, where you have no mention of survivors, the scriptures mention that there are survivors, along with talking about, quote, the utter destruction of the Canaanites. And we also need to understand that that term utterly destroy can simply mean victory, being victorious over. Sometimes the word utterly destroy, haram, simply means exile. For example, in Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 9 through 11, God says he's going to utterly destroy the people of Judah, the southern kingdom. And what is meant by that is that they will simply go into exile. Their cities will be in everlasting desolation. But even two verses later, it says in verse 11, it says that this desolation is only going to last for 70 years. So it's going to be a short period of time. Even though that exaggerated language is being used, Judah is not being utterly destroyed. It's not genocide whatsoever. So those are some considerations that we need to remember. And keep in mind, too, we talked about that language of oppression. We talked about that man from Rwanda with whom I was speaking. Well, keep in mind, too, the Israelites had just come out of the land of Egypt, where they had been oppressed by the superpower of the day, the Egyptian Empire. And where they're going is to these cities of Canaan, which are actually colonized city-states that belong to the land of Egypt. Egypt is the power that oversees those cities. And so some scholars have said that the Canaanites would have actually been glad to see the Israelites coming through and disrupting the power structure of the Egyptians in the land of Canaan. So those are some things that we ought to keep in mind. So that's the Canaanites. Now, should I keep going and talking about the Amalekites here? I mean, there's something to add here. Proceed. Okay. All right. Let me say something about the Amalekites. One more thing about the Canaanites. Let me give an example of the exaggeration in the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 2 and 3 tells us about these two kings, Sihon and Og, who are the Amorite kings. The Israelites want to pass through peacefully, but these two kings actually take up arms against the Israelites and fight against them. Numbers 21 tells us that these two kings were basically fighting as military, a military army, combatants only. So we read about the king, his sons, and his army fighting against the Israelites and losing in battle to the Israelites. Deuteronomy, however, ramps up the language and intensifies the language and uses that wide-ranging rhetoric that is common in the ancient Near East, saying man, woman, young, and old. In Deuteronomy 2 and 3, it describes that same battle that was between combatant armies, but it throws in man, woman, young, and old as a rhetorical device, even though we know that women and children were not in the battle zone. So this is very interesting. In fact, we read even in that chapter in Deuteronomy 21 that the Israelites drove the inhabitants out of the villages and then engaged in this combatant battle with these Amorite kings. So it's very interesting to read that. But then again, there's that intensified language that you read about in the book of Deuteronomy. And I do talk about this in my book, Is God a Vindictive Bully, where I go into a lot more detail here. But let me say something about the Amalekites now in 1 Samuel 15, which is the primary passage. A few things to keep in mind. One, the Amalekites, which had been longstanding enemies of Israel, had just raided the Israelites. And we see that in chapter 14, verse 48, that they had engaged in a raid against Israel. So the Lord, through Samuel, tells Saul to go, and again, the language is to utterly destroy man, woman, young and old, etc., animals, etc. And so we read that. And then what do we see? We see that there is going to be a battle that is fought. And there is a city, it's called the city of Amalek in verse 5 of chapter 15. The city of Amalek is probably a citadel, some sort of a fortress where the battle is going to be taking place. Now, Saul hears that the Kenite peoples, they're Canaanite people, but the Israelites have had good relationships with the Kenites. Moses' father-in-law was a Kenite. And so he sends word to the Kenites that we're going to fight a battle against the Amalekites. So please don't remain. You're our friends. You should go. And so the Kenites actually end up departing. So we have to ask the question, if the Kenites, who know that there's a battle that's going to be fought, end up leaving, do you think that women and children would be in this battle setting? I think the simple answer is, of course not. They would be the first ones to be moved to safety. Then we read about the battle after Saul is done with his battle. We see that not only does Saul say that he utterly destroyed, the word haram again, that he utterly destroyed the Amalekites, but the narrator himself, this voice of authority in the text, is telling us that Saul utterly destroyed the Amalekites. Well, we know that there was at least another Amalekite, namely the king, King Agag, who was preserved alive, and it was like a trophy for Saul to show that he had conquered this king, and that he and the king assumed that he would simply remain alive. But of course, Samuel the prophet thrust him through and killed him. But the point here is that if we take this literally, that again, depending upon how you translate the term utterly destroyed, that if we take it as utter destruction, we have to ask the question, well, this means that they must be gone, that there must not be any Amalekites left behind. Well, actually, we read that later on in the book, the same book, in chapters 27 and 30 of 1 Samuel, we read about David fighting against an army of the Amalekites once again. So those Amalekites were actually not obliterated. This was not genocide. That the battle that took place in this city, and again, we were told that instead of keeping those animals as spoil for himself, Saul was to put the animals to death. But again, keep in mind that this is actually a battle scene where there were actually no non-combatants present. And so we see that sort of language of hyperbole. We see that language of exaggeration. And in fact, we see the language of exaggeration carried further when we're told that Saul fought the Amalekites from Arabia to the desert of Shur, which is east of Egypt. So basically, this is a huge, you know, tract of land. And this is common in ancient Near Eastern war accounts where you had a localized battle, which is in verse 5, the battle at that city of Amalek. And then you have, it looks like universal conquest, that there's that the localized battle plus universal conquest, which is a device used in ancient Near Eastern war accounts, which again adds yet another layer to that matter of exaggeration. So those are a few things that we could perhaps highlight as we look at these texts and as we look at the, it looks very severe at the beginning. It looks like non-combatants are being targeted, when in actual fact, this is simply two combatant armies fighting against each other, which is a common theme in the Old Testament. Once we read past the rhetoric and hyperbole of some of these ancient Near Eastern war accounts.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. That's really helpful, I think. But it also raises some other issues, I think. One thing I was thinking was the language. You mentioned that there was some hyperbolic language. Do you have some objective criteria to determine when the Bible passage should be understood as hyperbolic and when it should be taken literally?
Right. Yeah. Well, a couple of things that might be helpful to keep in mind. And I get this question whenever I speak about Old Testament ethical challenges and talk about warfare. There's that question about, shouldn't you be taking the Bible literally? You're talking about hyperbole or exaggeration here, and some people see this somehow as misleading. But I would say first that it's no more misleading than our own language when we talk about in sports, the sports world, we totally destroyed that team. No one takes that literally, but no one is being misled by that either. It's only because we are more removed from the ancient context where exaggeration was common, whereas you read, and again, I talk about these things in my book, Is God a Vindictive Bully, where I give examples from various ancient rulers who are described as having utterly destroyed or totally annihilated the opposing armies and so forth. Whereas in actual fact, we know from history that these were gross exaggerations. So one, keep in mind that there may be a way of understanding the text that as you look more deeply, you realize, oh, this is a common feature in those ancient Near Eastern war texts. Maybe the same kind of thing is true of other war accounts found in the Bible. And indeed, that is what we have present. Another thing to keep in mind is as you look at these war texts and you see that language of man, woman, young and old, and which gives rise to the accusation that this is genocide, when you look at it, you realize, but they say that on the one hand, but on the other hand, those texts also mention that there are lots of survivors. And I've been giving examples of how there are survivors repeatedly in all of these accounts. We see them, you know, and I just gave the example of the Amalekites, where it looks like Saul, quote, utterly destroyed the Amalekites. And this is, you know, but yet we see that there are plenty of survivors later on in that same book, which has led a number of commentators, Old Testament commentators, to say, maybe we need to step back and look at this term utterly destroy and recognize that maybe it simply means decisive victory rather than saying utter slaughter. In fact, that same word is used in Leviticus 27, where a field or an animal or a servant might be, and the word is haram, but they're not killed or destroyed. They're simply set aside from ordinary use to be used in the tabernacle by the Levites and the priests. But again, it doesn't involve death or destruction here. It just means setting aside from ordinary use. And again, as I said, sometimes the word haram simply refers to exile, not slaughter or genocide, as we saw in Jeremiah 25. So that, you know, and we can go in a lot more detail here, but I think it's just important to understand the background of these passages so that we can say, oh, something more is going on here. And I think one key indicator that this is hyperbolic is that you see, even after the mention that Canaanites have been utterly destroyed or that there are no survivors, you see lots of Canaanites that are around throughout the time of David and Solomon, even, that the Canaanites are still there. And really, the problem is not that Canaanites are alive. The problem is when the Canaanites are actually engaging in immoral activities or continue to practice their idolatry, which can actually lead the Israelites astray. And so that's why God says, destroy those shrines, those idols, those altars, and so forth. Because if you leave them around, your heart is going to be drawn back into those Canaanite practices and break covenant with the God who is united himself to you, and you would compromise your identity and your mission. So I think the very nature of the literature itself of war texts in the ancient Near East is itself an important criterion and an important indicator that we're dealing with a different type of genre, a different type of literature within the ancient Near Eastern world. And so we should treat it accordingly. It's kind of like we have in our fairy tales. When you begin a story once upon a time, you understand that you're being prepared for something that didn't take place in history. This is something that has its particular genre, its particular way of understanding things. And so you need to adjust your mind to prepare yourself for that rather than saying, oh, when did this actually happen? It says once upon a time. When was that? What year was that? We don't operate that way. In the same way, when you see this sort of language of quote utter destruction, no survivors, you say, oh, you know, that's looks very similar to other war texts found outside the Bible. And then you start to see that there is a pattern that is developing. And so these can provide clues for us about how to understand the Bible. So rather than taking the Bible literally, sometimes we take it literally, sometimes we don't. It's better to talk about taking the Bible literarily. Are we treating the Bible according to the type of literature found within it, whether it be parables or metaphors found in the Psalms, or historical narrative, or proverbs, or epistles, or apocalyptic found in the book of Revelation, which is highly symbolic? So we don't always take the Bible literally, but we should always take it literarily.
A skeptic might say that referring to hyperbole is just a trick Christians could use to downplay the brutality of such commands and to avoid facing the issue head on. How would you respond to that?
Right. Yeah. Well, actually, when I first, I grew up in a Christian home, and so was from my early days onward, I would read these texts and I took them at face value. I just assumed that this is just literal, straightforward historical description. But it's actually through doing more digging, looking at the text. And I know that there are Christians today, and there are some scholars who say this is the only unique example of genocide, that it was because it was divinely commanded, God had a morally justifiable reason for commanding genocide, but it was unique and unrepeatable and so forth. And so there are Christians who do take that view, and I certainly understand that. John Calvin, for example, took that view. But another view that is, I think, becoming much more noted and significant is the view that I'm taking, that we're largely talking about combatant warfare. And what I, it's through the examination of text where it said, it looks like it's hyperbole. When you realize that the language of utter destruction or leaving no survivor is actually inaccurate. There are survivors. We read about this in, say, in Judges chapter 1, where it says the Israelites could not drive them out. They could not drive them out. They could not drive them out. They could not drive them out. And so even though the language of Joshua, which is an ancient war text, talks about how the land had rest from war, that the Israelites had taken the land. When you actually look at what Israel had fought, what Israel had accomplished, really only 1/3 of the entire land that we're talking about had been taken by the Israelites during the time of Joshua. There's still much more to be done, even though it uses the very sweeping language to talk about Israel's conquest. This is just common ancient war text language. So when I'm telling people, you know, as they look at these texts, I'm saying read the text more closely. I'm saying you are downplaying the text if you're looking only at leave alive nothing that breathes, or man, woman, young and old, but you neglect the other side that refers to lots of survivors, that mentions that there are plenty of Canaanites that are still around, even in that very same location. You would have columns of quote utter destruction, and you would have a column of lots of survivors. Let me give an example of how this works. In Deuteronomy chapter 9, God tells the Israelites that he is going to, you know, that the Israelites are going to be, you know, driving out the Canaanites, but they're going to do so slowly and gradually because the Israelites are not very numerous, that there are wild animals in the land and so forth. So God is going to say, I'm going to drive them out for you slowly or gradually. But you read in chapter 7, just a couple of chapters earlier, that God says, I'm going to drive them out quickly before you. So you have side by side, as it were, a kind of an idealized language of we're going to drive them out quickly, but then the more realistic on the ground, you know, practical sort of language saying that, you know, I'm going to drive them out little by little, that you're not going to be able to drive them out quickly. So is it quickly or is it not quickly? And so if you understand that there is that kind of tension, that there is that kind of idealization language, and then kind of the practical on the ground realistic language, you could hold those things in tension without saying, oh, here's a contradiction. No, that's just how the Bible is using that kind of genre of war text. But at least the Bible does mention that there are plenty of survivors, which other ancient Near Eastern texts tend to ignore and gloss over. So the Bible is actually be much more realistic than other ancient Near Eastern texts.
Yeah, I think that's plausible to show it on the text itself. I think that is helpful. Let's bring in another perspective on this, another theologian, Clay Jones. I think you know him. Once he wrote an essay titled, We Don't Hate Sin, So We Don't Understand What Happened to the Canaanites. Could you briefly explain what he means by this, and would you agree on that?
Yeah, Clay Jones, and it's a great article in which he says, you know, basically outlines the kinds of practices that the Canaanites engaged in. Again, horrific sorts of things where you have the for one thing, the gods of the Canaanites engaging in incest and bestiality and rape and so forth. And so you see that the kind of gods that the Canaanites are worshiping, actually, of course, this, you're not surprised to see the Canaanites themselves engaging in incest and bestiality and ritual prostitution and infant sacrifice. It was horrific. And so when you look at these kinds of practices, you know, what Clay Jones is saying, for God to utterly wipe out all of the Canaanites, is, you know, that there's nothing unjust or nothing morally inappropriate about this. And as I know that there are people who take the view that this is a kind of a once for all genocide that is unrepeatable, but it's for a particular time. It is during this period of the unfolding of salvation history where God is bringing the Israelites into the land and preparing the way for the coming of the Messiah. But the, you know, what I would say here is that, you know, I mean, the Lord, if he commands something and it is severe, he will have morally justifiable reasons for doing so. But my point is that when I look at the text, I actually don't see this happening. Even though Joshua, as we're told, did all that Moses commanded, we see lots of survivors here, and that the language itself does not suggest genocide. And of course, if you look at the very cities themselves, the cities of Canaan are actually citadel cities where there are where you have soldiers, where you have administrators. They're sometimes treasury cities, storage cities, but they're not where civilians are. And as I just pointed out, many of the Canaanites would have been very glad to see the Israelites coming through and driving out the oppressors that are under Egyptian control. Because, you know, we know from how the Egyptians treated the Israelites that the Egyptians could be real thugs and oppressors and make life hard for everyone. So again, there is that angle as well. Interestingly, as I've talked to Clay Jones, he said, in fact, if my book in 2022, it came out in October, and Christianity Today, a Christian magazine here in the United States, had book awards, and Clay Jones did the book reviews for the apologetics and evangelism books that were being given awards. And I had an award of merit. So I was like this, you know, number two in the book awards. But Clay Jones wrote the review of it, and he told me that he was persuaded by my hyperbole argument, that he said it makes sense. He said, I don't have any problem with my former view that it was total genocide of a wicked people, but you've made a very strong case that this is hyperbole. And in fact, he went on to say that your book should have been, rather than just simply the book for apologetics and evangelism, it should have been the book of the year. He really thought very highly of it. So I really appreciated that kind commendation from Clay Jones. So that's a little bit of personal background on that whole discussion. But again, it does highlight, first of all, that there was a very wicked people, and that God commanded the Israelites to drive those people out, unless they, of course, abandoned those things and they could align themselves with the Israelites, which many of them did. But we also, you know, we also see that, as I noted, that God is actually more concerned about the Israelites and their identity not being compromised by the Canaanites. So if there's a willingness for the Canaanites to live under the rule of God, the one true God in the land, then the problem wasn't with the Canaanites any longer, because they were pretty much not obstructing the identity and mission that the Israelites had.
Yes, thank you for your opinion. So maybe we can continue with some of the more challenging Bible passages.
And as though the other ones weren't challenging, but go ahead, yes.
Yes, this time about death penalties for what seem to be tribal matters. For example, we read in Numbers about a man gathering wood on the Sabbath, even though God had forbidden work on that holy day. Or in Deuteronomy about a son who is disobedient to his parents and is to be stoned by all the men of the town. So skeptics might say a God who orders the death penalty for such a tribal matter is barbaric or evil. How can we understand these passages?
This is a point of contention or stumbling for people who read languages, the language of stoning or burning or that sort of a thing. And the penalties seem very severe and disproportionate. And in this case, we actually have, you've listed two, in a sense, case studies or two examples where you have the death penalty carried out. And I think the way to read this is that we're dealing with two exemplary cases. One dealing with, as it were, the first set of commandments that relate to Israel and God, and then the second set of commandments that relate to Israel's relationships within, you know, their, with their own community. So loving God and loving neighbor, you know, basically the two tablets, the two commands are arranged that way. So you have, you know, again, one death penalty corresponding to each of those tablets, each of those the loving God, loving others being violated. One of the things that I point out in my book, you know, my first book on this topic is God, a Moral Monster. I did take these penalties as being more, well, for one thing, these were penalties that could be implemented. But primarily, one of the things that I pointed out is that the book of Numbers also mentions that there are 16 potentially capital offenses within Israel. But the only one that was unexceptionally to be carried out or executed was that of murder. When you have murder, then there is to be the death penalty. But for all the others, and scholars take this kind of in general, that they could be commuted to monetary payment. So when we look at those penalties, yes, we see an example here, but it's not as though that was the way that the Israelites dealt with these violations on a regular basis, you know, taking everything to court, for example, for adultery. And I have a chapter on the topic of adultery in Israel in my book, Is God a Vindictive Bully, where I've kind of modified a little bit and expanded on the matter of death penalty questions. Because I think what a number of scholars have pointed out is that these penalties of stoning and burning and so on, these were typically not carried out in Israel. These were basically kind of, you know, again, we have that language of hyperbole or exaggeration to get the Israelites to kind of pay attention, to take notice that these are, that extreme language is being used to warn the Israelites to avoid those things, to stay away from those things. Those things are bad. And again, this is how in the ancient Near East, you would have penalties that were similar. We'd have very strong penalties that went along with certain violations. But if you took them literally, it actually wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. So for example, in the Code of Hammurabi of Babylon, you have language of, say, a someone who botches or blunders in a surgery and causes physical damage to his patient. Well, should that person be put to death? You know, well, that's the penalty that's called for. If a person is a builder, has a house built, but yet the building collapses, well, that man's son should be put to death. Well, who would go into the building business if you had that kind of a risk? And so a number of scholars have said this is an example of kind of strong language associated with the penalties so that people would take care, for example, when you're a surgeon, not to take shortcuts as a surgeon or a builder. You want to do things the right way so that you don't, you know, cause trouble for your patient or for someone whose home you built that it collapses and so forth. So there is that language of exaggeration that actually carries into the matter of punishments. So yes, you do have a kind of a maximum penalty that could be carried out, but basically, most of those penalties, 15 out of the 16 potentially capital offenses, could be commuted to monetary payment or simply resolving things interpersonally. So we read about adultery in the Law of Moses. We read about it in narratives. We read about it in the book of Proverbs. And rather than the penalty being death, we see that there may be some sort of a payment that is taken, or that there is simply a resolution between the parties where this is somehow resolved. But it's not assumed that it goes to court and that there's going to be a death penalty that is issued. And I do talk about that, and I talk about the woman caught in adultery, and I deal with some of those maybe secondary questions that will come up. But that is my take on the penalties in the Old Testament. So, you know, I compare this to what we see going on with Ananias and Sapphira in chapter 5 of the book of Acts. In Acts, you know, this couple, they lie about how much money they have given to the church. They say that they give all the money that they received from property that they sold. But Peter points out, you kept back part of it for yourself, and you have not lied to man, but to God, and so forth. And they're struck dead. Now, it doesn't mean that God deals that way with every lie in the New Testament or beyond. This is just kind of as the people of God, as the church, are a fledgling young community. This is kind of a warning for people to beware that there is a God who is also severe, who takes this seriously, and that you need to be on guard against trying to get away with certain things within this community. So it sets a certain tone, a certain sobering tone for the church in Jerusalem to be aware of these things, just as in early on in ancient Israel's history, that these were a couple of warnings for them as well. But that doesn't mean that was carried out in practice, and especially since it was understood largely as something hyperbolic.
Paul, let's assume you are right in everything you said so far. Even then, it doesn't seem that this would be the way of a perfect God making a law. So my question is, why would a morally perfect God conform to the brutal standards of that time? I think it would be far more fitting for him to establish a timeless universal moral idea. And doesn't this undermine his moral superiority?
Well, it may actually highlight the wisdom of God in recognizing that you're dealing with a people whose mindset is not ready. And so God steps in to where they are, gives them legislation that may be less than ideal. It may be a concession, and that God is, however, attempting to point his people in the proper direction. So this is what we see Jesus talking about in Matthew 19:8, where he's talking about divorce. Even though divorce is not part of God's ideal, we see that in Genesis chapter 2:24, where Jesus in fact quotes it in Matthew 19, where, for this cause a man will leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, the two shall become one flesh. What God has joined together, let no one separate. So Jesus is actually pushing back on the permission for divorce. Now, I do think that there are conditions where divorce is permissible, and we see two clear examples of that in the New Testament. But this is not God's ideal, and Jesus is reminding his audience that even though it's permitted, this is not God's ideal. Why does God permit divorce? Well, it's because of the hardness of human hearts. So Jesus himself recognizes that this is not ideal. This is not the way that God wants it. But given a hard-hearted people, that this is the best he can do with the people who are in this particular position at this time with a certain mindset that they have. But God is attempting to move them in a proper direction. Yes, you can give certain moral ideals to maybe you're trying to help rehabilitate criminals or something like that, or you're trying to help people who have an inferior moral understanding. You may have to be incremental in how you do something. You may not be able to, you may give them the ideal, but they won't care about it because they are not at that level of appreciating it. So in the same way, God does give the ideals in Genesis 1 and 2, fundamental equality of all people made in the image of God, marriage between a man and a woman, and so forth. Well, that's just not where the Israelites are. That's not where things are in the ancient Near East. And so God works within that kind of a setting to accommodate himself, to in some ways get his hands dirty and allow for certain things like divorce, even though this is not God's ideal, but God does desire to point them in the proper direction and often points them back to the ideals that were laid out in the creation story.
Yes, thank you very much. I am going to continue. There are even more Bible passages where God is accused of being disproportionate. Take, for example, the story of 2 Kings, where I'm going to quote, Elisha went up to Bethel. As he was walking along the road, some boys came out of the town and jeered at him. Get out of here, Beltly, he said. Get out of here, Beltly. He turned around, looked at them, and called down a curse on them in the name of the Lord. Then two bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the boys. An atheist once told me, the killing of 42 children, or even if they were teenagers or adults, is excessive. Punishing mockery with death is tyrannical. What would you say to that?
Well, again, it is helpful to have a little bit of context here. And I appreciate the fact that this person said, even if they're adults, this would not be morally justifiable. And I think that that is what we do have here, that we do have not little children, but actually young adults, people who are unmarried, males who are, you know, they could be used, you know, the language is used of, you know, that same word that's used of these youths or children. It can be used of a king whose contemporaries, you know, who are called, you know, these youths, you know, that King Rehoboam, you know, is basically calling on his friends to advise him about what to do. But we read about in First and Second Kings, for Second Samuel as well, that the people who are in, you know, who are described as such are often men capable of fighting in battle. Sometimes the various translations will be used for these as, you know, young men, or, you know, sometimes perhaps like junior officer, the New International Version translation of the Bible has to describe these. So we are dealing with young men, but those who are unmarried, but they're capable of being married. So we see this language is used of the sons of Jesse, you know, men who were involved in battle, for example. These are the children of Jesse, whom Samuel in 1 Samuel 16 is examining. And so David is also called a young man, the same word that's used, you know, in this passage of Elisha and the bears. And he had already killed a lion and a bear before he killed Goliath, but he's called a young man or a youth. So, and again, I can go on to talk about how, you know, some scholars even say that these young adult unmarried males probably even have a connection to the royal house, the royal priesthood in Bethel, which is a center of idolatry. So it's important to understand what's going on here. You know, in the northern kingdom of Israel, Bethel was a center of idolatry, of false worship. So we have people who are basically opposing the covenant of God and are engaging in their own form of worship. And it's interesting too that 42 young men were killed here. Interestingly, later on in that same book, in 2 Kings 10, there are 42 young men from the royal house of Omri who are killed. So it seems that there is this symbolic number connected to kingship, but also there's this connection that is being made of potential blessing and also curse. The, you know, what's interesting is that the Israelites should have been aware, although a lot of people ignored the covenant that God made with the Israelites, that if the Israelites abandoned the covenant, if they engaged in idolatry, as we see in Bethel, that God said he would send wild beasts to the Israelites and that they would be bereft of their children, or they'd be rendered fruitless of, you know, that is that they would have no more children. Those children would be taken from them by those animals. What's interesting is that when Elisha had already been ministering before he came to Bethel, he had gone to other places. For example, he goes where there is, you know, water that is bitter, that is basically not helping the land to be fruitful. And so Elisha goes and makes the water sweet again. And so that language, that water can make the land fruitful again. That word fruitful is the same word that's used of, you know, in the book of Leviticus, where there is that, you know, where you'll be bereft of your children. You'll be rendered fruitless rather than fruitful because you're not obeying the covenant. And so Elisha, here is this prophet representing God, representing commitment to the ideals that God has called Israel to. And what we see in the northern kingdom is these people don't have a regard for the covenant of God. They don't have a regard for God's warnings, the curses or the blessings that could come by, you know, how they treat the law of Moses. They're totally ignoring it. And here a prophet comes and he is being mocked instead of being seen as someone who is actually a messenger of God who can bring blessing and fruitfulness to the land. Here, what ends up happening is just what the curses of Leviticus predicted, that if you curse God's representative, if you curse the covenant and ignore it, these are the sorts of things that can happen to you. So it wasn't without warning. God said this sort of a thing would happen. And we had just seen Elisha go to a place where there had been fruitlessness, and then the waters became sweet through a miracle that Elisha performed. And now the land was blessed. So this is the kind of picture that we have. But I think a lot of times we look at just this particular incident and ignore the larger picture of what God wants to do with Israel. Israel was on very shaky ground often because God had called Israel to be his chosen nation, to maintain its identity of loving God, maintaining the covenant that God had graciously made with Israel after bringing them out of the land of Egypt. So Israel had an identity to preserve and a mission to carry out. And when Israel was engaging in these sorts of practices, the very identity and mission of Israel were totally compromised. Israel had a mission to prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah so that all the nations of the earth would be blessed as God had promised to Abraham. So this is very significant that Israel had completely neglected its call to be God's distinctive people, and it simply capitulated to the idolatry of the surrounding nations. And so therefore, there's a threat of judgment that God had promised to the people of Israel if they engaged in these types of practices.
I think we can skip to a different kind of question. And people often seem to misunderstand each other because they end up talking past one another. And even like in the topic we discussed today, when people have fundamentally different worldviews. And what do you think are Christians often get wrong when we discuss these challenging Old Testament passages with atheists?
Yeah, I think it is part of this whole discussion requires, I think an important component of this conversation requires patience that we need to be as Christians, and James 1 reminds us of this, that everyone ought to be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. And oftentimes, Christians can be very quick to speak and very slow to listen. And again, it's a human problem. But we can often talk without listening to what the actual criticisms are, and perhaps we're treating certain biblical passages in a superficial way, and it looks like we're actually not taking seriously what the text is saying. And that it can be disconcerting for, say, an atheist who is approaching this. I think a problem with the atheist as he's engaging with a Christian is that a lot of times there is biblical illiteracy, that the atheist simply doesn't know the scriptures. So that could be one problem. And so it involves a lot of patient listening and discussing and getting to the bottom of an issue. But if the atheist doesn't have the patience to actually work through these sorts of challenges, then it can be time, that just is wasted on someone who's not really interested in digging in to what the text may actually really mean. But on the other hand, too, with the atheist, sometimes, say, for example, when it comes to the matter of the Canaanites driving the Israelites out of Egypt and understanding that, a lot of times the atheists will pick and choose certain things that they will allow the Bible to say, and then they'll ignore everything else. So, for example, when it comes to the Canaanites, they will lay their eyes on a passage that says, man, woman, young and old, leave a life that breathes. And then you say, well, a couple things. One, this is hyperbolic language. Secondly, you need to understand the broader text and allow the biblical story to stand as it is. Because if you kind of pick and choose what you want to say, oh, this is what the Bible is saying, but that can't be what the Bible is saying, this leaves all sorts of problems and you have an incoherent story. So let me give you a few examples. When we're talking about driving out the Canaanites, one, we need to understand that God had particularly called the Israelites to be God's chosen people. God had told the Israelites that they were to be his people. And if you treat Israel just as any other nation, then you will fundamentally be compromising the story, because Israel is unique. It's not just one nation, quote, invading another nation. That is unfair to the text. You know, another thing to keep in mind is that the Canaanites saw the signs and wonders. They knew the signs and wonders that the Israelites had seen God do. They were aware of the story of God's delivering the Israelites from Egypt, of the 10 plagues in Egypt and so forth, bringing them through the Jordan River. The atheist is going to say, oh, I don't believe in miracles. Well, you've got to allow those miracles to stand to have a coherent story. You know, also part of the miracles were that, you know, was that God was present with the Israelites as a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, which would be a very daunting and even frightening thing for the Canaanites to witness. So you have miracles. You have God's bringing the Israelites out of Egypt to the pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. You have Israel as a unique people of God, and that there is a global mission that the Israelites have, and that they need to preserve their identity in order to move forward with that mission that is actually going to encompass all the nations of the earth, including the Canaanites, as we see in the Old Testament in other passages, like in, you know, in Zechariah and the Psalms. But if you just pick and choose and say, oh, I can't believe that I had a God who would allow, you know, who would command the Israelites to drive out the Canaanites, and you ignore all of those other pictures of features of the story, it's actually an unfair representation to the storyline of Scripture. And I tell people it's sort of like taking Gandalf out of the Lord of the Rings and having a coherent story. And so what I would plead with people, say, let's just assume that this is the entire story, that this is, that there is a God who exists, who chooses a people, who desires to bring blessing to the nations, who performs signs and wonders and so forth. Then you have a much more coherent story. You also take into account the wickedness of the Canaanites and so forth, that God has waited patiently for over 400, 500 years. Well, this is, you know, to neglect all of those things is, I think, going to be a stumbling block for the atheist to actually hear the story of what's going on and to make better moral sense of what the biblical story is trying to capture. So those are a few things that I believe are important for us to consider as we engage with other people in these sorts of conversations. But again, it takes a lot of patience as we're dealing in cross-worldview communication with others.
Okay, let's go to the end to a last question. And I want to quote a German theologian, this time Matthias Clausen. He once said, one of the greatest obstacles to faith is not at the level of reason, but at the level of imagery. Very often it's our personal image of God that keeps us from him. So it seems relevant to our topic today. Paul, what expansion of our understanding of God are these challenging Bible passages forcing us to consider? And maybe you can also say, why would you say that in the end, even these expansions lead us to see a God characterized by absolute love and goodness?
Well, a couple of things here, and I appreciate Matthias Clausen's point. Of course, it could be taken a couple of ways. You can, there could be a kind of obstacle in that we can have a faulty image of God that prevents us from seeing God as being a God of love and so forth. On the other hand, there could be a personal image of God that ignores wrath and judgment. And people say, oh, this is a God I can believe in. This is a God with whom I feel safe. And we may be creating a kind of idol or caricature of God that allows us to maybe live and feel more comfortable in our own position, rather than ignoring, you know, and we may be pushing off a God who is described in Romans 11:22 as both kind and severe. So God, there is the severity of God and the kindness of God, and we need to understand both of those. Or in the C.S. Lewis's book, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, Aslan, the Jesus figure, the lion, is described as both good but not safe. Jesus is good, but not safe. And we certainly see that in the New Testament, that for those who are hypocrites, those who are rebels and so forth, Jesus is not safe. And so we need to understand that kind of a perspective, but also trying to put wrath and anger into proper perspective too. The problem is not that God gets angry. God is indeed described as being slow to anger. And in fact, James reminds us that we, as followers of Jesus Christ, need to, and I quoted it before, we need to be quick listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. If we never get angry, that is a problem. And we see in the wrath of God a picture of a God who loves the world so much that he's going to get angry when people are abusing themselves, who are abusing others, who are taking advantage of others. In fact, the New Testament scholar N.T. Wright says that if God is not wrathful, he is not loving. Oh, when God just says, it's okay, it doesn't matter, you can go ahead and do those things anyway and harm people as you want, that is not a loving God. A God who is, in fact, I like to quote from Miroslav Volf, who had was a theologian who came from the former Yugoslavia, and he didn't believe in that God was angry or wrathful until he and his people had gone through the war in the former Yugoslavia. And he saw his villages destroyed. He saw women, brutalized villages, destroyed. He saw people displaced. And he said, I couldn't believe in a God who didn't get angry at these things. And he concluded that he had to believe in a God who got angry and wrathful. And he said that God is not wrathful in spite of being love. He is wrathful because he is love. And so often we often pit these against each other rather than seeing them often working together, that God is concerned about human beings. And when other human beings are harmed, God says he will step in and take action. He will hold us accountable. He will bring judgment either in this life or the life to come. So those are the types of things that we need to remember as we look at God. God is kind, Romans 11:22, but God is also severe. And if we did not have a God who was severe with those who engaged in evil activity, that would not be a God who is truly loving.
Paul, thank you so much for this talk. I think it is so important to talk about these passages and think them into the great picture of the Bible. And I think it was really, really wise and eye-opening what you said. And I remember when I first read Is God a Moral Monster? It was really helpful to see this is not compromising the Bible or the text, but is diving deeper into it, like you said it today. Thank you so much. Bye.